Hey folks, Evan Davis here, producer of Conscious Voices. Some unexpected obligations this week have precluded me from producing a new edition, so this show will be a repeat of last week's very timely examination of the threats to democracy in America. But speaking of which, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema made a speech today on the Senate floor, reaffirming her opposition to changing the Senate rules to end the filibuster in order to pass critical voting rights legislation. She voiced what sounded like a full-throated support for the two pending voting rights bills, but then reiterated her support for the filibuster. Due to Republicans' lockstep objections to protecting voting rights, this means there is almost no chance of the bills being passed in the Senate, thus making Sinema a pivotal figure in this chapter of American history, one whose legacy will include the Republican advantage that will follow for a generation or more, and the damage they'll do on many fronts. Remember that Republicans wanted to open federal lands adjacent to the Grand Canyon for uranium mining, and Obama had stopped that with an executive order, then Trump then rescinded that order. So in Sinema's America, not even the Grand Canyon will be safe. I could go on, but our senatorial candidate Morgan Harper issued this rebuttal that I thought you would hear before the repeat Conscious Voices edition.
Earlier today, Senator Kyrsten Sinema delivered a floor speech in which she said that she will continue to support the filibuster. Here's what that means in practical terms. No voting rights legislation, no Freedom to Vote Act, no John Lewis Voting Rights Act, continued unfettered action by Republicans to steal the vote away from people of color across this country and try to rig elections in their favor. To be clear, and I will say it again, siding with the Republicans to defend the filibuster, in doing that, Kyrsten Sinema is blocking President Biden and Senator Schumer's efforts to protect our rights to vote, despite claiming to support the legislation. Sinema is the exact kind of politician that we do not need more of in Washington. She prioritizes donors over her constituents. This is a senator who opposed the raising of the minimum wage and obstructed President Biden's Build Back Better agenda. This is not the kind of senator that Democratic Party needs. The voting protections that Democrats are seeking to pass right now are supported by a wide swath of the American public. They would restore the Voting Rights Act, which was gutted by the right-wing Supreme Court, and they would enact protections against right-wing legislation happening in state capitals all over the country, including here in Ohio. Sinema has boldly claimed that she supports and considers Congressman John Lewis a hero, but she's helping Republicans block the legislation named after him in his memory with her defense of the Jim Crow filibuster, the very tool that has been used time and again in this country to block progress for Black people. In fact, the most famous use of the filibuster was to block the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Racist senators blocked passage of the act for 60 days. Decades earlier, it was used to block an anti-lynching legislation. Make no mistake, Sinema's prioritizing this racist procedural tactic in the name of bipartisanship over progress for people of color. She is helping Republicans on their path to destroying our democracy. It's worth mentioning here, too, that only 3 out of 100 senators currently are Black. There are no Black women in the United States Senate. Ohio has never elected a Black senator. It is clear that we need more senators in Washington who know exactly what's at stake for Black people and for voting rights generally. Sinema's defense of the filibuster is also not rooted in reality or facts. She has characterized it by falsehoods and misinformation. She's saying that this is necessary to protect democracy and to avoid ricocheting policy outcomes every few years. But the Senate operated as a majority rule institution for most of its existence. Prior to the 1960s, the filibuster was used rarely and only for bills that were about civil rights. Without the filibuster, our system of government will still have more checks and balances than any other modern democracy. The filibuster is the problem, not the solution. And Sinema and her partner in obstruction, Joe Manchin, have emphasized their belief that lasting, meaningful change can only come through bipartisanship. Well, unfortunately, we are not living in a bipartisan time. The Republican Party will not come to the table when it comes to protecting the right to vote, and we cannot wait for them. As Representative Jim Clyburn pointed out, the 15th Amendment giving Black people the right to vote was enacted on a party line. Are they seriously trying to claim that this is illegitimate? This week in Georgia, President Biden reiterated the need for both the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Act to pass. He discussed the need to protect democracy, especially in light of the events of last January 6th. an attempt to steal election and continue to threaten our democracy. We cannot sit idly by while these extremists seek to disenfranchise a large portion of the American public. During the height of the voting rights movement in the 1960s, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. noted that the filibuster was a, quote, tragedy. It was used by misguided senators, he said, to block people from even voting. This is MLK Jr. Day weekend, and we must work to honor his memory and of so many other civil rights leaders who came before us to pass both of these bills. Democrats can't afford to miss the opportunity to act now, and we cannot afford to elect more senators like Kyrsten Sinema. That's why I'm running for the United States Senate. I understand what's at stake. We in Ohio, who have been living under a partisan gerrymandering regime, understand what's at stake, and we need federal intervention now.
Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. It is the anniversary of the most recent storming of the and partial sacking of the Capitol building, this time by white supremacists, neo-Nazis, nouveau Confederates, defenders of Confederate monuments, gun fetishists, anti-vaxxers, climate change deniers, and other Republican and Trump supporters. It's been a whole year, and though more than 700 of the perpetrators have been arrested or indicted, and a handful so far have been convicted, the investigation by the Justice Department under Merrick Garland has not appeared to be very aggressive and may not be inclusive enough in its scope to include the financiers and the plotters behind the would-be coup. Those, as the evidence currently suggests, could include various Republican members of Congress and secretaries of state, certain media outlets, Mike Lindell, purveyor of pillows, myths, and vitriol, and maybe even some right-wing churches. We wonder aloud whether Garland really intends to be as thorough as the circumstances would seem to warrant, or if he's pulling his punches for political reasons. Surely the outcomes of the investigation could affect the midterm elections this year. It could backfire if indictments are issued but not forcefully prosecuted, or if subpoenaed individuals are allowed to skate with nothing more than a contempt of Congress penalty. Or it could, perhaps, result in Republican Congress members being censored or impeached, which for Democrats might be a small temporary victory. Certainly, if the crimes of 1 year ago are not rigorously prosecuted, it could serve to encourage future assaults on the government. Already, we're witnessing death threats and harassment against election officials across the country. Lawmakers are looking over their shoulders and worrying about their families and houses and pets. Taken in sum, these are all part of a concerted campaign to not only achieve specific policy goals or affect electoral outcomes per se, but also to undermine and discourage and even cripple the very mechanisms of democracy. Now, some on the right would argue that the outcome of the 2020 presidential election was fictitious and that there was widespread fraud. That, too, is intended to set the stage for rhetorical objections to future elections that don't go the way the Republicans would prefer. But we know that no such fraud occurred, and it's been investigated by independent as well as bipartisan commissions, election integrity experts, investigative journalists, and technical experts alike, and tried in the courts and even disproven outright, as was the case in Arizona, where even the highly partisan pro-Trump private investigators that were allowed unfettered access to the ballots and electronic voting machines for more than a month declared their inability to validate any of the allegations the Trump regime had made. But there's also a danger, in my opinion, of treating January 6, 2021 as an isolated incident. And the broader and the longer view one develops here, the less relevant the distinction between the two parties, at least prior to this administration, becomes. The stormers of the Capitol plotted for weeks quite openly on social media platforms and in public pronouncements, but they were preaching to an already prejudiced choir, not only of the alt-right sociopaths, but also to politically less literate, disaffected people with deep-seated concerns about their future welfare, not necessarily unfounded. The process of their political and economic disenfranchisement has been generations in the making, with policies during Democratic administrations, as well as others, being as much to blame as those of their rivals. Al Gore, who actually won the 2000 election, we later proved, had only the finest, tiniest of majorities, as he failed to inspire voters with the kind of progressive policy agenda. He represented, in a real sense, a perpetuation of the status quo. Likewise, John Kerry, who may have been perceived as a hair to the left of Al Gore in 2000, really didn't offer very much in the way of fundamental change. Indeed, his campaign message was more defensive than proactive. He promised to defend Social Security and public education, which Republicans had wanted to privatize, but he made no mention of universal health care, lowering the Social Security eligibility age, which Reagan had raised, and he had no plan for increasing funding for public education, let alone a strategy for confronting the housing crisis, or raising the minimum wage, funding a transition to renewable energy in such a way as to boost the flagging economies in Appalachian coal states, etc. Hillary Clinton, too, whose rhetoric was arguably to the left of Kerry's, and whose brief voting record in the Senate was actually pretty good, was widely perceived as representing the old and tired centrist ideology that her philandering husband had proliferated during his tenure. It wasn't only the deep and wide cultural currents of sexism that made her vulnerable to vicious propaganda smearing from Republicans or their Russian or Israeli social media engines. She achieved some of that criticism the old-fashioned way. She earned it. Likewise, it was not only the active and racially targeted voter suppression laws that Republicans are pushing in state after state that have caused low voter participation, even as so much is at stake. Many would-be and former voters have responded to decades of political intransigence and cycles of promises made and then not kept by abstaining from the process altogether. At the street level, in economically deprived neighborhoods, there may be little tangible change from one administration to the next, regardless of what one party promises and the other threatens. It seems to never get any better or worse, and the status quo is itself injurious and unacceptable. In this era of Republican obstructionism, what is needed is a party of resistance and action, allied with a broad grassroots movement that is actually getting things done on the ground that hamstrung legislators cannot. It's the only thing that will rekindle both enthusiasm and confidence in the electoral process. We need a period of fighting and doing. I credit the Biden administration, and more so the Progressive Caucus, for ramping up the fighting rhetoric and doing all they can to make progress on a number of fronts. They're not doing enough, sure, but they're doing more than any previous Democratic administration since Roosevelt or Johnson, both of whom were reluctant, where this administration is unapologetic in its promotion of social welfare and environmental protection policies and its embrace of equality. Clearly, the Republican attacks on voting rights and their promotion of so-called big lie about the 2020 election are aimed at countering the allure of progressive policies, just as Mitch McConnell's partisan filibustering of virtually every Democratic proposal is intended to deny the Biden administration any measure of meaningful success that might trickle down to the street level and bring a drop of sunshine to the wrath-grape non-voters there. So this is the broader context, in my view, in which the technicalities of voting rights, election integrity, and the prosecutions of the insurrectionists are being discussed, or should be. Please keep that in mind as we present a recent podcast from the polling analyst aggregator group 538.org.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. This is our first podcast of 2022. Happy New Year to everyone. I hope you all had the opportunity to celebrate, reflect, relax, however you like to mark the beginning of a new year. This week also marks the anniversary of a somber day for the country, the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. It has been a year since a group of Trump supporters violently entered the Capitol and temporarily prevented the 2020 Electoral College votes from being counted and certified. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, it appeared that Republican leaders were maybe ready to break ties with then-President Trump once and for all. His attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election were apparent, as was his support of the people who entered the Capitol and his reluctance to stop them. But a year later, Trump still appears to be the de facto leader of the Republican Party, and those within the party who voted to impeach him over January 6th are pariahs. So today, we're going to take a look back at the year since the attack, what we've learned about the events of the day and leading up to it, how it's shaped our democracy and the party since, and how likely future political violence may be. Joining me to discuss are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, everybody.
Also with us is politics reporter Alex Samuels. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Galen.
And tech and politics reporter Kaylee Rogers. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey, good morning.
Later in the show, we're also going to speak with Brightline Watch, a group of scholars that monitors democratic practices in America, their resilience, and potential. Okay, let's begin with our favorite question, good use of polling or bad use of polling? In the year since the January 6th attack, many pollsters have asked Americans what they think about democracy itself, Is it working? Is it in danger? So for today's example, I want to ask about a new poll out from USA Today and Suffolk University. The Hill wrote up the poll with a headline stating, quote, 8 in 10 worried about the future of democracy in US. The survey shows 51% of Americans say that they are very worried about the future of America's democracy, 32% say they are somewhat worried, and only 15% say they are not worried at all. So at first blush, it looks like many Americans are in agreement in their pessimism about our system of government. But the question here is, does this question mean different things to different people? Does one aggregate response to this poll tell us anything? So essentially, of course, is this a good or bad use of polling? Who wants to kick us off?
Well, I think in this case, it's a good use of polling because we do have that context in the poll, because they also asked respondents about their thoughts on the big lie. And I think that really demonstrates the sort of parallel universes that America is living in, and that both sides are really worried about democracy, but for very different reasons. With those who believe in the big lie worried about democracy because they think that elections are being stolen in front of our very eyes. And the other side being concerned because they think that people are responding to this in a negative way and starting to erode democracy as a way to kind of respond to that fear of election fraud. So I think this is good use of polling. And I think it's really important, even when you do the aggregate, although there's two different reasons behind it. If 80% of the country is worried about the future of our democracy, it's worth noting and looking into.
As Kaylee's kind of getting at, there are two separate phenomena here. And the reason why Republicans are worried about democracy are not the same as the reason Democrats are, and are generally speaking kind of less grounded in reality, frankly. There are contradictory data points on how concerned Democrats are. There are some polls that show that a lot of Democrats are not that concerned, actually. They got their president elected. Democrats control Congress, albeit barely. So that's actually like not the same from poll to poll. And we can talk in the next segment about why that might be and why necessarily rank and file Democrats don't seem to feel the sense of urgency. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with the poll per se, but it's a little vague if you're just talking about the what and not the why.
Yeah, as Nate was getting at, you know, it's hard to propose solutions when Americans are divided over the perception of democracy itself, including, you know, whether it is even under threat, why it's under threat, and who is responsible for that threat. I was kind of, you know, on the fence about this poll, mainly because it didn't say anything that I don't think we already knew. You know, especially among Republicans, there's this discontent and disillusionment with the current political status quo, which has led to confidence in democracy slipping. But as Kaylee and Nate were both getting at, the poll doesn't tell us, you know, what it is Republicans need in order to feel as though democracy isn't in danger.
Yeah, I guess I'm curious, like, what does it mean to be worried about the future of American democracy? When people answer this poll, are they thinking, I don't like American politics right now? That's a pretty, I guess, simplistic view, and probably they're thinking a little more deeply about it. But, like, what does it actually mean? Do 80% of Americans think that our system of government is going to end?
Well, CBS News had a similar poll. It was released a few days before this one. But they asked the people who felt like democracy was threatened what they believe the biggest threats were. And they also asked those respondents to rank whether these threats were major or minor. And what they found is that the people who felt like democracy was under siege were most concerned with three things. And those three things were A, the potential for political violence, B, people voting or casting ballots illegally, even though we know that happens on very rare occasion, and C, the influence of money in politics.
I guess given that, Alex, as you mentioned, there are very different reasons that people may be concerned about the future of American democracy. And as you said, Nate, some are more grounded in reality than others. Like, it seems like a flashy headline to say 80% of Americans, or more, it's 83% of Americans, are worried about the future of American democracy. Is that, like, too alarmist? Is that properly alarmist?
I don't know if that's the right framework for it, right? I mean, this is, you know, ironically, like, it's not up to Americans to vote on how worried they are about democracy. And to some extent, I'd be more alarmed if people were less worried, right? At least in theory now, there could be some guardrails against certain things that that state legislatures might do, for example. No, it's, you know,
what
it's
do you
mean? Well, if people are just turning a blind eye to things, then, you know, people could get away with more, right? If the state of, I don't know, I mean, hypothetically, Although, again, remember, we have this big partisan split in why people are worried, right? Hypothetically, if no one cared about this, the state of Wisconsin could just say, we passed a new law that from now on the state legislature will appoint Wisconsin's electoral votes, right? You know, they could do that probably under the Constitution. And, like, you know, what prevents that? Well, it would be unpopular, presumably. And so the more people are concerned about threats to democracy, the more of a cost there might be on that, right? Or the more of a norms might be against it potentially. So, yeah, I mean, you should be more worried when people are less worried about something that actually is harmful.
Right. I think also Alex makes a good point where by lumping it all together, it maybe elides the point that whatever solution there might be that would make people feel better about democracy, that's only going to work for, you know, I guess half or so of the people that are worried. If you pass a bunch of laws that make it really difficult to vote, that might, although we haven't seen this yet, assuage some fears of people who are concerned about voter fraud, but those who are worried about voter rights will be even more concerned and vice versa. But I think also, I mean, especially from that CBS poll that you mentioned, Alex, democracy is sort of obviously a very big concept that covers a lot of things. But what we're talking about for the most part here is elections and concerns about how elections are run and whether or not votes count and whether or not people are able to actually vote. And then election subversion being kind of like the more sinister outcome of that.
These are all topics that we're going to discuss momentarily. But all in all, how do we rate this poll? And I would say, The Hill headline, as I mentioned, was 8 in 10 worried about future of democracy in U.S. The USA Today headline was different. It was a year after January 6th, Americans say democracy is in peril, but disagree on why. So maybe one of those is a good use of polling and one of them is bad.
I give the poll 3.5 Yelp stars. Or you can't give half stars on Yelp. 3 stars.
Given inflation, that's pretty low. I mean, I wouldn't eat dinner at that poll given that rating.
By the way, this gets into my pet peeve now, where like rating systems where any rating apart from the top rating is considered like an insult. You know what I mean? I think are useless rating systems. But yeah.
I mean, would you eat dinner at that poll if it was rated 3.5 stars?
I have a lot of hacks for Yelp, right? First of all, if the people who gave it a low rating were eating brunch, then the restaurant might be good, actually. Because people who eat brunch and post reviews on Yelp are dumb.
Wait, I love this.
It's a hot take.
Perfect.
Yeah. You want, I'm interested, I mean, nothing wrong with brunch, right? But like, I'm interested in the opinion of dinner eaters, unless like a breakfast place or something, right? Brunch eaters just provide a lot of noise, right? Yeah, you eat brunch to have fun, right? Not as like a culinary adventure. And as like a somewhat serious foodie, then like, I don't want brunchers polluting my dinner reviews.
I mean, this almost makes sense.
This is such a hot take.
The somewhat serious foodie who has dollar slices of pizza?
Again, you want the high and low play, right?
Dollar slices.
You want the high-end sushi omakase one night and then the $1 slice of pizza the next night. That's where my strategy to everything, really.
Brunch Eaters of America, I'm curious to hear your rebuttal of Nate's extremely hot take impugning your judgment.
I like brunch to a degree. I just don't want people, you know, but you're not doing it for the food for brunch, right?
I think you have a point in that.
It's an excuse to like day drink and see your friends.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that, but like, yeah.
Even the best brunch like doesn't necessarily tell you much about what a dinner service is like at that restaurant.
There are other cues. Like if someone uses the term like hands down, like, oh, this is hands down the best fried chicken I've ever had. Like no one ever uses the term hands down. That's like a fake Yelp review, right? That's a dead giveaway. No one ever uses that phrase in real life.
I have never reviewed a restaurant in my life. So I do always wonder, you know, like has anyone on this podcast ever reviewed a restaurant?
Yes,
or a service?
I did one last month. My favorite ramen spot is apparently under new ownership and is terrible now. And I just felt the need to let people know because they didn't change the name. And I was very disappointed when I went back there.
All right. So that tangent aside, it is a middling use of polling. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. It's,
and a middling use of ramen.
I'd say it's a good use of polling, bad use of ramen.
Yeah. I prefer the going back to the poll. I prefer the USA Today headline slightly over the other one that you had mentioned, Galen, but because the poll didn't give a lot in terms of like solutions and, you know, why Democrats think democracy is where it's at and why Republicans think it is, you know, because it was lacking in some aspects, I, you know, kind of put it middle of the road leading toward bad use of polling.
Fair. Yeah, I'm left thinking, okay, 80% of Americans think that the future of American democracy is in trouble. What does that mean? And maybe we will be able to address that in our next segment. So let's move on. It's been a year since we all sat down here at 538 to live blog the results of the runoff elections in Georgia's two Senate races and ended up watching a group of pro-Trump extremists attack the U.S. Capitol on live television. I want to kick things off by drilling down on what exactly happened that day. And Kaylee, one of your beats here at 538 is extremism. So in the year since that day, how has our understanding of what happened evolved?
Right. I mean, it sort of, again, depends on your existing viewpoint, because once again, we have sort of parallel universes where people have very different ideas of what happened that day. But the fact is, we sort of reached a fever pitch of all of the rhetoric around the big lie that had been continuing to simmer since the election, and a lot of anger, a lot of passion among people who had come to DC that day. And Trump's speech really kind of tipped them over the edge. I mean, we see this in the court filings from individuals who were charged in the attack. They straight up say, like, I was just there to protest, and then Trump told me to go to the Capitol, so I did. It was a really unique moment in time, a unique moment in history that hopefully we won't see again. But it reached a moment where it was completely unprecedented, and just the emotions and everything ran so high that we ended up with this really monumental attack on our Capitol.
I think it is easy to forget the part that Kaylee was talking about, which is the incitement part, right? You know, one question is why this hasn't been repeated, and it may be because you didn't actually have the active president of the United States actively inciting people to, we have to do something about this, right? After a months-long campaign to undermine the integrity of the vote counting process. We talked about this, Galen, on the pre-holiday episode, but the extent to which Republicans have not moved on from Trump. I mean, I guess it seems obvious in advance. I don't think it necessarily seemed obvious at the time. I mean, you did have a decent number of Republicans vote to impeach and remove Trump, clearly not a majority, right? But it seemed at least possible that the tide would shift. Usually parties do not want to have much to do with their losing presidential candidates. I think we'll talk about this in future parts of this show. But like, in some ways, the fact that like January 6th has not become, I don't think, central to the nation's political consciousness, I think is interesting, maybe not as surprising. I think it's something that like kind of people who are big consumers of political news think about a lot. I don't think it's the kind of thing that like the quote unquote average American necessarily puts on that pedestal. There is polling saying that, for example, Americans do not see January 6th as a September 11th like event. They see it as something which is serious, but not at that level. And so that's interesting. Potentially, too. You can kind of blame the media for that, or kind of, we can talk about that later, but like, those are just some random thoughts I have.
Yeah, I think and this might, you know, it feels almost naive in retrospect that any of us had this idea at the time, but there was certainly a sense on that day that this might be an event over which we could all agree was a negative thing. You know, we all saw this happen in real time as a country, and Republicans' sort of initial response to it was not to defend Trump, not to defend the insurrection. And but even on that day, and I've done some writing on this that's forthcoming, you know, there was messaging happening, starting to bubble up already to completely reframe it. And by reframing it, we've got, you know, a big section of the country that doesn't see it as a negative, horrible thing that happened, that sees it as either a false flag or, you know, some kind of conspiracy thing, or just, you know, patriots that were protesting and voicing their opinion as their right to do. And that, you know, it was no worse than, you know, tourists visiting the Capitol, that kind of thing. So those are the kind of views that we ended up happening, which is such a big shift from sort of the reality that we were all in that day.
Nate sort of waved at this earlier, but I think immediately after January 6th, I had this feeling of, oh, like this will be the straw that breaks the camel's back for Democrats, like especially like the more moderate and centrist ones. Like surely now they'll be on this side where they feel, you know, the GOP is the party of Trump. We are not going to work with them anymore. Let's just get our priorities passed and like call it a day. But that hasn't really seemed to happen. It really seems like there are some Democrats in Congress, Biden included, who really still post January 6th, like cling on to this like idea of bipartisanship. And I wouldn't have imagined that in the immediate aftermath of January 6th. So I don't know how much January 6th really shaped our politics or kind of the makeup of Congress or how, you know, certain Congress members feel about working across the aisle.
I think the only thing that could have made a difference would have been Trump's reaction himself, because Trump remains so incredibly popular among Republicans. A majority of Republicans still want him to run for president. And the idea that the GOP was just going to turn their back on this extremely popular figure was just unrealistic. However, if for some reason Trump had decided to come out more strongly against it, to say, hey, look, this was too far, I don't condone what happened, this was a terrible tragedy, if that had been his messaging, I think we would see a totally different response from his base, and sort of we'd have kind of a collective reply to it. Instead, he was very defensive of it, you know, has been defensive of the individuals who have been charged in the attack, saying that they've been mistreated, and obviously continues to beat the election fraud drum, which spurred this whole thing to begin with. He's taken zero responsibility, and that messaging is really powerful.
It kind of sounds like you're saying that the whole reason, much of the reason that this didn't turn into a 9/11 type event in the nation's consciousness is because of Trump. But does he hold all of the cards in terms of how America understands attacks on its seat of government? I mean, could the Republican Party have taken a different path? Could the Democratic Party have taken a different path? Could the media have taken a different path?
The reason why it's not a 9/11 style event is because, like, it was ultimately unsuccessful. It's as if three of the four planes had been stopped before taking off, and like the fourth one crashed into the Atlantic Ocean or something. You know, we can debate how close it was to being successful, but it's hard to get people to worry about like a near miss, unless you're kind of like a political connoisseur, right? The original SARS, right, was a near miss. It ultimately wasn't like a global pandemic. It was regional and not that bad, right? That didn't necessarily make people like that conscientious about the next pandemic. Hell, even with COVID, there still hasn't been that much of a drive to like fund research into future pandemics, you know? So it's like, people have a high threshold for wanting to change their points of view and ways of life. And the fact that, like, I mean, the thing is, it is, like, obviously very visually very disturbing, too, right? I don't know. I think there's not, like, a good way to put it. But, like, it fell just kind of below the threshold of turning dramatically violent, where many people were killed. And I kind of assumed at the time that either protesters or police or members of Congress that, you know, that there would be dozens of fatalities or something, and it didn't quite hit that threshold, and I don't know.
Well, doesn't it also have to do, though, with an attack from an outsider versus an attack that kind of fits into your internal domestic political debates?
I think that's right. You know, I think the fact that the call was coming from inside the House makes it much more complicated. It's so much easier to demonize sort of the other with someone attacking, whereas these were Americans. These were people who feel very strongly about their country and their democratic rights, clearly, that they came to D.C. to protest. So that complicates it. And I think Nate's right that the level of violence doesn't rise to that level. And to really contextualize it, you have to think about it in the context of history. You have to think about what could have happened. You have to go back and review, you know, video footage that we've seen since that really kind of captures just how dramatic and how violent and how close we were to something even more catastrophic it was. At the time, you know, it was hard to get footage. I was watching live streams of people that were actually there, but a lot of people were just kind of watching whatever cable news could get their hands on sort of from above and sort of this distance view. And it wasn't until we started having tapes released as part of the hearing and as part of the trials of those who were arrested that we've started to see really just how close we were to disaster. And if you're not keeping up to that and you've already maybe written it off in your mind as not that big a deal, you're not going to recontextualize it.
I also think there's a difference in how the law treats like foreign versus domestic terrorism cases. And so I think the rioters, by my understanding, were always expected to receive, you know, less of a legal punishment than, you know, compared to 9/11, the Muslims who were prosecuted on nonviolent charges of providing like material support to foreign terrorist organizations. But I feel like one big difference why, you know, January 6th did not reach like this, you know, 9/11 level significance beyond what's already been said is because after 9/11, like U.S. Muslims resoundingly denounced like Islamist militant groups. And I feel like they faced pressure even to apologize for attacks that many had nothing to do with. But as we talked about earlier, the GOP today has accepted little to no blame and has tried to really distance themselves from the attack. I do think that if the rioters were predominantly non-white, then maybe the response would have been slightly different too.
And just to really quickly respond to your question, Galen, about Trump holding all the cards, I don't want to give him 100%, you know, responsibility and credit, but I don't think we should undermine the role that he played both in instigating this attack and in shaping the response to it after the fact. Obviously, the GOP had other options than to just side with him and go along. I think the Democrats also could be more forceful, especially in response to, you know, trying to pass voting rights legislation. There are other paths. It's not all just about Trump, but I do think that he plays a significant role here.
Right. There was nothing like the 9/11 sense of bipartisan unity after January 6th. And I think Trump played a role in contributing to that. But I don't think, again, that this all falls on his shoulders.
It's also an event that's hard, I think, for people to put into a category. There's this debate about whether it's a coup or not. A lot of academic
or a coup
experts,
attempt.
A coup attempt. Some academic experts say, no, it's actually not because the military, importantly, wasn't involved. Other people might say, you know what, that's really kind of splitting hairs. And maybe it doesn't mean this definition, but clearly it's in the same kind of general constellation of events as a coup. Some people call it like an auto coup or an auto golpe as a Spanish word or something like that. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But it's a lot of things at once, right? You know, I think it's estimated that something like 10,000 people were in this protest slash riot slash insurrection in Washington, D.C. that day. Some of them were not particularly nice people. You have groups like the Proud Boys, right? But you also probably do have like Mary from the accounting department thinks the election was stolen and goes there and it was peaceful, right? And so it's lots of different things at once. And that kind of the amorphousness of it allows people to manipulate themselves and others into how they describe it.
I think that's a really good point. And we don't really have a modern comparison to try to fit it into. You know, it's not really comparable to 9/11 for all the reasons we've already covered. And, you know, the closest comparison is like from the War of 1812, when the Canadians burned the White House down, or the British, depending who you ask. That's not useful for people to make that kind of comparison. I think it's such a unique event in modern times.
It is unique, but I think that a lot of people coming off of January 6th, the main question was, will something like this happen again? What will future elections look like now that this one has been so delegitimized by the then president? What kind of answers can we provide people? Like, why hasn't something like this happened again? The extremist groups that were involved in January 6th, you know, I know that you've covered them, Kaylee. What do they think about the state of America now? And have they kind of given up? What are they still making plans for future political violence? What does post January 6th democracy look like?
I do think that there were so many factors at play here that made this kind of like a perfect storm event, which is why we haven't seen things happen again. And Trump's role in that is obviously a key factor. But the tensions and the dissatisfaction that was simmering and built up to that sort of, you know, rolling boil of January 6th, those are still there. And if anything, getting worse. There's a deep distrust of elections among many Republicans. Their belief that the election was stolen or illegitimate is not reducing at all. It's not starting to fade in any way. And concerns about the legitimacy of 2022 and 2024 remain pretty high. There's polling that shows that people think that if their preferred candidate doesn't win, that's a sign that there's something wrong and there's election fraud happening. So all of those simmering concerns remain and I don't think are going anywhere fast. There's sort of different perspectives on how to address that, whether that's through a Voting Rights Act at the federal level, or, you know, Republicans believe that passing some of these voter restriction laws is going to help quell those fears at the state level. but we've seen they continue. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but this is sort of the status of the ecosystem at this point. People are still very unhappy and deeply believe that there is flaws in the election system.
Political scientist, I believe his name is Robert Pape. I don't want to butcher his last name, but he had a really good op-ed in the Washington Post looking at what motivated the rioters. And he essentially said it was racism and white resentment that drove a lot of them to the Capitol that day rather than actual fear that the election was stolen. So going off of that, he made the point that a similar mob could be summoned by Trump or a Trump-like figure. And that's because the country is moving towards becoming a majority nation. And on top of that, right-wing media outlets continue to stoke fear about this, you know, great replacement, which could mean that the racial and cultural anxieties that many of the rioters had will not go away. And as Kaylee mentioned, you know, there's this record number of bills proposed that aim to essentially restrict voting access or enable partisan interference in elections. We already know that a lot of these bills, I guess now laws, were motivated by the big lie. But a major consequence is that they could help Republicans tilt elections in their party's favor. Obviously not very good for a healthy democracy. So I don't know about, you know, the risk that this could happen again necessarily, but I think that some of the underlying fears that the rioters had, those aren't going away. And that is pretty worrisome.
The thing that's also tricky, and I think Kaylee's kind of getting at this, is like January 6th and like, quote unquote, the threats to democracy are like not perfectly parallel, right? If you ask kind of like, you know, the 10 most eminent scholars of erosions to democracy, what threats are you most concerned about in 2024 and beyond? I don't think they'd rank a repeat of January 6th at the top. I think they'd more talk about like, about what if a state legislature doesn't approve the results? You have a dispute in Congress, right? We can talk about gerrymandering and voting rights and whatever else, right? But like, it's kind of like, I mean, there were debates ahead of time about like in 2012 or 2020 about like kind of how could the election be stolen potentially? There were things like, well, the GOP will stop the vote count once these kind of late return ballots get in and the courts will support them. And that's how the election will be stolen. Right. There are people, you can go back and look at like some prescient Twitter threads about people predicting a January 6th like outcome, but it was not the most common scenario that people kind of thought. And so, you know, to what extent is when Democrats have a commission on January 6th, to what extent is that helping people to be more concerned about democracy and threats to it versus like, not being quite on the nose to what the threats might be next time around. You know, I mean, I think maybe kind of one lesson from January 6th should be that like when you have a set of actors, meaning Republicans in this case, who are not committed to democracy, then you don't necessarily kind of know what form it will take, right? It might be something unpredictable that isn't the exact scenario that you plan for. And so what that means, I think, is difficult. It probably means you need to have like a lot of different defense mechanisms at different parts of the chain of events, right?
No, I think that's right. And there's also a bit of a risk of hyperbole on the left, similar to what you see on the right, where there's this belief of like this widespread conspiracy to steal the election, which is like so unlikely, and fears about certain outcomes that seem unlikely on the left, rather than focusing on what's actually happening. Like focus on what laws have already been passed that are concerning. Focus on what state legislators have said they plan to do. That's what we should be concerned about rather than sort of fanciful scenarios of really kind of scary outcomes. And, you know, so much depends on outcomes of elections as well. And so raising the alarm about what could happen, if that then doesn't happen, it sort of undermines the alarm, even if it was a perfectly rational and reasonable response to what we're seeing. It's really hard to make predictions. And so covering this with the right amount of skepticism and alarm is a tricky balance.
All right, let's leave things there. Thank you, Nate, Kaylee, and Alex for joining me today.
Thank you, Galen.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to speak with Bright Line Watch about the health of American democracy, according to surveys of both Americans and experts who study democracy. Since 2017, a group of democracy scholars at Bright Line Watch has been tracking what Americans and experts think about the health of democracy through a series of surveys. We last spoke with them in June when a notably high number of Americans, 37%, showed support for their region of the country seceding from the Union. Back then, we debated the usefulness of such a poll. The group just released updated polling in December, and Brendan Nyhan, professor of government at Dartmouth College, is here with me to discuss. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe we'll get to the secession question a little later, but more importantly, thinking about the events of January 6th a year ago and the kind of main polling that you've been doing over, you know, these past 4 or 5 years, have we seen any real reaction to January 6th itself in terms of worries about democracy?
You know, it's hard to say. The term democracy, I think, is one that's difficult to parse. Even experts often disagree about its exact meaning. And to the public, I think it can seem like an abstraction. What I would say about the change since January 6th is I'm struck by how little there has been. It did seem like there was a moment in the immediate aftermath of the attack when there would be a full-scale repudiation of the events of that day and the effort to overturn the election that led up to it. Instead, we've seen public opinion largely locked in place. We still see a dramatic partisan division in views of the legitimacy of the 2020 election. You know, those are remarkably stable in our polling. And even more worryingly, the problem is getting worse in the sense that we now see a greater partisan division and confidence in the 2022 election than we saw immediately prior to the 2020 election.
So when people tell you that they're worried about the integrity of future elections, what are they worried about?
So the question that we're using here is confidence in the count. So we're essentially asking people, do they believe these false claims that election counts are inaccurate and that there's widespread voter fraud or electoral fraud to manipulate the literal election totals that are being reported in terms of who won and who lost? So that really strikes at the heart of democracy itself. The lack of confidence in those totals is very worrying. Now, we don't know how far people's beliefs in those statements will go, but we saw on January 6th it can go quite far. And if we go through a whole election cycle where those claims are repeated, where they burrow deep into people's minds, I do worry about the basic norm of elections, which is that both sides respect the results. The losers accept the legitimacy of the winning side's victory. Without that, we have nothing in a democracy. And right now, the polls show that that confidence is worryingly divided along party lines.
What percent of Americans say that they doubt the vote will be counted as intended in the next election?
Yeah, so we found that 62% of Americans were very or somewhat confident that votes will be counted as voters intended in the November 2022 election. So that top line number is similar to what we saw back in October 2020 when it was 59%. However, we see this dramatic partisan split. Back in October of 2020, we found 66% of Democrats expressing confidence in the nationwide vote count compared to 58% of Republicans, an 8 percentage point difference. Now we see 80% of Democrats expressing confidence in the vote count compared to only 42% of Republicans. So we have this much wider partisan difference. The top line number hasn't changed, but we're now seeing only a minority of Republicans expressing confidence in the vote count. And of course, that's critical because we need both sides of an election to accept its legitimacy.
What is there to be done about this? Because it seems like anything that would, as we discussed earlier in this podcast, anything that would allay the fears of Republicans would stoke the fears of Democrats. Anything that would allay the fears of Democrats would stoke the fears of Republicans. And then that's just the perception category. There's also the question of, you know, how do we shore up our democracy against any actual threats to it? Does Brightline want to have answers here?
Well, there are things you can do. So one thing we did in our most recent report is survey experts for their views on how to reform American democracy. And a plurality supported reforms that could be undertaken without a constitutional amendment, which are obviously the ones that are most feasible given the difficulty of that amendment process. And we asked them to evaluate a number of reforms that might help strengthen American democracy. Now, they don't directly speak to your question, Galen, in terms of confidence in elections themselves. You know, for that, I would say, you know, a very large number of prominent political scientists have supported you know, the Freedom to Vote Act in Congress as the most direct way to strengthen American elections. Now, that won't fix public confidence in elections, but it will protect the elections themselves. In other words, it will help protect the process from the consequences of this distrust. Similarly, fixing the Electoral Count Act, which is vulnerable to manipulation, potentially, as we saw on January 6th, would help reduce the consequences of this distrust in the election system. The reforms I was alluding to before might help change the electoral incentives in some cases that cause Republican elites to question the integrity of the electoral system when they're defeated, and to double down on an approach that seeks continued minority power, you know, the differential minority power they currently enjoy. Some of these changes might impact that. Changes to redistricting laws, electing the president by the national popular vote, expanding the Senate, and so forth. So there are things that could be done. Whether they're politically feasible in the current environment, of course, is a different question.
This is maybe a cynical question, but this is a kind of maybe pessimistic conversation. How much of a priority is having a Democratic government for Americans? Meaning above and beyond what their policy preferences or partisan identity may be, how much do Americans want to live in a country where you win based on a majority of people supporting you and your ideas?
So if you ask people, do they support democracy? They typically say yes. There's a standard survey question that asks on a scale from 0 to 10, how important is it for you to live in a democracy? And the mean is something around an 8.5 in the United States. So people say living in a democracy is important. And in fact, at Brightline Watch, when we ask people about specific principles of liberal democracy, we see widespread support across party lines. The question, though, is whether people will prioritize those democratic principles over their own preferences, over the policies that they would prefer to see enacted and the people they would prefer to see holding office. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And unfortunately, we haven't seen the American people willing to turn against their party when it does violate those important principles, or when it does threaten the stability of the democratic system. There's research on this that asks people to choose between two hypothetical candidates and actually tests how often they will vote against who might otherwise be their preferred candidate because of one of the candidates expressing some statement or position that violates democratic norms. And in those cases, people do seem to penalize candidates, but not as much as we think. And that's with hypothetical candidates. Now imagine it's someone like Donald Trump, who people have an emotional connection to and a longstanding history of support for. That becomes much more challenging. The final thing I'll say about this, Galen, ultimately people do have more important things going on in their lives. People are worried about how the economy is doing. They are worried about COVID. Abstract concerns about democracy are just not going to be top of mind for everyday people, and that's fine. The problem is when we have a political system that encourages politicians to attack the system itself, and we have a political class that fails to reject those candidates and parties that would undermine the stability of the system. That's always been how democracy has been supported. The political class has to defend those norms or they can fall. That's very directly the lesson of the book How Democracies Die by Steve Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. There's a screening function that the political class plays. And it's up to those of us in the media and in academia and in politics to defend these norms, knowing that the average person is not thinking about them in the same way. That's okay. We still have to defend them.
Yeah, I looked at some research by Matthew Graham and Mylon Spolak at Yale, and their research suggested that it was, you know, the portion of the electorate that would make their voting decision based on democratic principles primarily was like 3.5% of the electorate. And so that may seem really alarming. I don't know, maybe it is to you, but you're saying like that's nothing new. That's how people operate. It's the elites that are responsible for upholding democracy.
And the elites are going to have to step up because it's simply unrealistic to ask the public to put democracy over all else. We need a political system that is robust to these kinds of threats. And right now, our two-party system isn't.
Has this dynamic changed at all in the sense that people feel like losing has become more and more unacceptable? Do people today feel like their party losing an election is a greater harm to them than in past elections?
It's certainly plausible. We don't have the longitudinal data to answer that scientifically, but I think many people have that feeling that politics seems existential to the most committed partisans, that affective polarization, for instance, is at record high levels. People feel very negatively about the other side. So the idea of the other side holding office seems unacceptable. And maybe it's okay to overlook violations of democratic norms in order to keep your side in power. Now, I can't tell you that chain of reasoning is more prevalent now than it was in the past, but it certainly seems plausible. And actually, let me just add one more caveat on that, which you can cut out if you like. But just to say, it's really important when we have this conversation, Galen, for the audience to know that we're really talking about United States in the post-civil rights era, right? From 1965 on, we were not a full democracy until we enfranchise all of our citizens. The stability of American democracy, of course, overlooks all the ways we were undemocratic prior to that period. So it's just an important caveat to all of these conversations. Black people, obviously, in particular, did not get to have a choice about who they accepted in office, for instance.
Your recent report shows that partisans underestimate how committed people from the other party are to democracy. Basically, Republicans don't think Democrats care about democracy. Democrats don't think Republicans care about democracy. But in fact, they do. How did you test, and why are partisans so pessimistic?
Yeah, this is a really interesting line of research that's become more common in recent years. Social scientists have started to think about what you might call meta misperception. That people have misperceptions about, how misinformed the other side is. And similarly, that they might be misinformed about the commitment of the other side to the political process and the norms by which we decide who holds power. So in this case, we ask people to estimate the percentage of people in the party they support or identify with, and the percentage of people on the other side who said a given democratic principle was important. And what we found was the expected pattern. People who, when asked about their own side percentage, they guessed the percentage of people who would say that principle was important was much higher than for opposition partisans. They underestimated, in other words, the percentage of opposition partisans who affirmed the importance of these democratic. We then corrected those misperceptions for a random subset of our respondents, and we told them the actual numbers. We told them, you actually underestimated how many people on the other side support these small d democratic principles. We then looked at the effect of that correction on their willingness to support various kinds of abuses of power while in office, right? So did this make people, in other words, less likely to say their own party should violate democratic norms? We found an effect, but it was a very small one.
So wrapping up here, your name is Brightline Watch, the organization. How concerned are you all about future political violence in America?
I can't speak for all of my co-organizers, but I do think everyone feels some sense of alarm. Political violence can be widespread without being widely supported, and it can be tremendously damaging even if it's not frequent. Even if we're not in a civil war, we could have real paroxysms of political violence that are very damaging to, obviously, the victims of any violence that takes place, and more generally to everyone who participates in the political process and has that shadow hang over them. I've been really struck by the reflections on January 6th and its aftermath and how it's affected everyone who works in the Capitol. Political violence echoes. It reverberates even when it's relatively rare. So I do think we are alarmed.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me today, Brendan.
My pleasure.
My name is Galen Daruk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. Claire Bittigieri-Curtis is on audio editing. And Emma Riley is our email. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us.
That was a podcast presentation from 538.org, a polling analysis group that aggregates polling data and offers election predictions and which analyzes political currents underlying voting trends, at least to a point. I hope you found that thought-provoking and informing, and that you'll indeed feel that way generally about this show, Conscious Voices, which is heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. By the way, both stations are wanting to upgrade our transmitters and have launched a fundraising appeal to get that done. You can check our websites at WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org to make a contribution.